Imagine you're skating 20 miles an hour.
Yeah, which is terrifying on its own.
Right. And you have three large men actively trying to drive you into a wall.
Sounds like a typical Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing. You have exactly half a second to calculate, spatial geometry, probability, and physics. And it all has to happen over a patch of ice that is exactly 12 inches wide.
Just 1 foot of blue paint.
Today, we are not talking about like acres of real estate or square footage in a city. We're dissecting that single foot of blue paint on a sheet of ice. The hockey blue line. Welcome to Deep Dive.
It's great to be here.
And if you're listening to this thinking you can just casually tune out because you aren't a hockey player, you might really want to reconsider.
Oh, absolutely.
Because what happens at this 12-inch boundary, it's an absolute masterclass in spatial problem solving. It's risk management and high-speed decision making that really applies to almost any dynamic environment you can think of.
Yeah, it really is a perfect microcosm of strategic thinking under pressure.
Yeah.
Because that 12-inch line represents this incredibly rigid mathematical and physical boundary.
Right.
Crossing it effectively means you have to manipulate momentum. You have to understand precise rulebook geography and manage risk in fractions of a second. It is the exact threshold where games are won and lost.
Because you could have the fastest skaters in the world, right? Yeah.
Exactly. The fastest skaters, the most accurate shooters. But if you cannot navigate the entry across that blue line, you're just never going to get the chance to use those tools.
And that's our mission for our time together today. By the end of this deep dive, you're not just going to understand a little bit of hockey
Oh,
strategy.
we're going way deeper than that.
Yeah, you're going to possess a fully integrated mental model of what is called a zone entry. We want you to be able to explain it to anyone, recall the hard data backing it up, and deeply understand the why and the how behind every single fast-paced decision you see out there on the ice.
We're going to build this up from the very ground floor.
So, to build that foundation, let's explicitly define our core concept. What exactly is a zone entry?
Right, so in its simplest terms, a hockey rink is divided into three zones by two blue lines. The zone entry is just that specific moment your team brings the puck across the opponent's blue line.
Entering the attacking third of the ice.
Exactly, the area that contains the net you're actually trying to score on. It sounds incredibly basic, I know. You have the puck, you cross the line.
Right, seems simple enough.
But the method you use to approach and cross that line, like whether you carry the puck on your stick, whether you dump it into the corner, or whether you delay and wait, that one choice dictates the entire sequence of events that follows.
Okay, so before we can learn how to optimally enter that zone, we actually have to clear the slate a bit. We have to unlearn something.
Unlearning is usually the hardest part.
Oh, for sure. And I think this is where the psychology of sports and really just the psychology of human risk aversion gets so fascinating. We have to unlearn arguably the biggest misconception in hockey.
The absolute terror of the blue line turnover.
Yes. The paralyzing fear of losing the puck right at that boundary. And to dismantle that fear, we really have to look at the numbers.
The historical context here is so critical because for decades, the conventional wisdom in hockey was totally built on risk avoidance.
Coaches are inherently risk averse,
No,
right?
completely. They remember the catastrophic mistakes way more vividly than the routine successes. So the prevailing logic was always, if you are pressured at the blue line, do not try to make a fancy play.
Just dump it.
Yeah, dump the puck deep into the offensive zone and go chase it.
Yeah.
Because the fear was that if you try to carry the puck across the line and, got stripped of it, you would instantly trigger this massive counterattack for the other team.
Which makes sense intuitively, right? I mean, it's like avoiding the stock market completely because you're terrified of a 1% dip.
That's a great way to put it.
So you just keep your money under a mattress. It feels safe. You aren't going to lose the money under the mattress.
But over time, you are losing massive amounts of potential value.
Exactly, because you aren't letting it grow. You're sacrificing this immense upside just to avoid a highly visible downside.
That is a brilliant analogy, and it perfectly sets up the data that completely shattered this conventional wisdom. We have to look back to a foundational study.
This is the MIT Sloan one, right?
Yeah, presented at the 2013 MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. A researcher named Eric Tulsky led it.
And he wasn't even a hockey insider initially, was he?
No, not at all. He was a nanotechnology chemist who just started tracking this data as a hobby before it completely revolutionized the sport. He and his group hand-tracked 330 NHL games from the 2011-2012 season.
Hand-tracked? That is dedication.
It really is. They wanted to measure exactly what happens when you cross that line. So they categorized every single entry as either a carry-in where the player maintained possession or a dump-in where they shot it in and chased it.
And what exactly were they tracking as the outcome goals?
The goals are actually too rare in hockey to give you a good statistical sample for something that happens dozens of times a single game.
Oh, that makes sense.
So instead, they tracked unblocked shot attempts. It's a proxy for offensive pressure. If you're generating unblocked shot attempts, it means you have the puck, you're in the offensive zone, you're tiring out the defense, and you're creating scoring chances.
So they were measuring the actual momentum and the threat level rather than just the final binary result of a goal.
Exactly. And their headline finding was staggering. At 5-on-5, carrying the puck across the blue line generated roughly 0.53 to 0.62 unblocked shot attempts per entry.
Let's visualize that for a second. A little over half a shot attempt per entry doesn't sound like a massive number in isolation.
Not until you scale it up.
Right, because a team might have 60 or 70 zone entries in a single game. If you're compounding that rate over an entire 60-minute game, you are generating a massive wave of offensive pressure.
It's an avalanche of offense.
So that's the baseline for carrying it in. What was the output for dumping the puck in?
Dumping it in generated only 0.22 to 0.28 unblocked shot attempts per entry.
I want to pause right there because this is the first major foundational pillar of our mental model today. If you're listening, what should we remember here?
The golden rule of transition.
Yes. Carrying the puck is worth double the offensive output of dumping it in. Not 10% better, not marginally more efficient, double. You are twice as dangerous when you cross that line with control.
And we really need to emphasize that this 2-to-1 ratio isn't just a quirky statistical anomaly from one old season either.
It's held up.
Oh, definitely. Since that 2013 presentation, this tracking has been replicated thousands of times. It's been corroborated across different areas of the game, across different styles of play, and in different leagues entirely.
Like women's pro hockey, junior leagues, all of it.
Yes, exactly. Getting in with control is mathematically twice as valuable as putting it in without control. It is just a universal constant of the sport.
Well, wait, I have to push back here because if you've ever been to a local ice rink or just watched a game on television, you still hear coaches and fans screaming, "Get it deep," or "Dump it in."
Every single game.
Right. The visceral fear of that blue line turnover is very much still there. If I'm carrying the puck and I try to make a move at the line, and the defender pokes it away, my entire team is caught skating in the wrong direction.
And the opponent goes the other way.
Exactly. They have a breakaway. So is that fear justified? Is the penalty for failing a carry so catastrophic that it actually outweighs the double offensive upside?
That is the exact objection every single coach raised when this data first came out. They said, sure, a successful carry is great, but a failed carry is fatal.
So how did they test that?
Well, Tolsky's group looked at it. Inside their larger study, they isolated a sample of games involving the Washington Capitals, and they tracked every single attempt, including the failures.
Okay.
And they measured what we call net expected shots.
Meaning they calculated the positive value of what you gained when you succeeded and subtracted the negative value of what you gave up to the opponent when you turned it over.
Precisely. It is a true risk-reward calculation. They found that a successful carry was worth plus 0.50 net shots.
Okay. Half a shot gained.
Right. But a failed carry, that dreaded, terrifying turnover at the blue line, cost only about minus 0.08 net shots.
Minus 0.08. That is tiny. I mean, it's not a free pass. Obviously, you don't want to turn it over. But it's mathematically nowhere near the absolute disaster that hockey folklore claims it is.
It really isn't.
Why is the penalty so small?
Because hockey is chaotic. Defending players who just broke up a play at their own blue line are usually pretty flat-footed.
They aren't already skating at top speed the other way.
Exactly. They don't instantly teleport into a breakaway. Most blue line turnovers just result in a messy battle in the neutral zone. So it is a penalty, but a very, very small one.
Wow.
And to add context to how small it is, the researchers looked for the absolute worst play on the board, the decision that cost your team the most net value.
Oh, this is going to be good. What was the ultimate mathematical sin?
Dumping the puck in and changing lines.
You mean when a player is just exhausted, they cross the red line, fire the puck into the corner, and skate directly to the bench to get a fresh player on the ice?
Yes, that exact play. That specific play cost minus 0.10 net shots.
No
way. It was literally worse for your team's mathematical chances of winning than trying to carry the puck, failing, and turning it over at the blue line.
That is incredible. So the thing coaches actually encourage players to do when they're tired is hurting the team more than the turnover the coaches are terrified of.
Exactly. The lesson the analytics revealed is that if you are so tired that you have to dump the puck and change lines, you should have changed 20 seconds ago.
Wow.
Using the dump in as a panic button to get off the ice is just the most mathematically damaging play in transition.
So let's synthesize this math for a second. The upside of carrying is doubled offense. The downside of failing a carry is mathematically tiny and actually less damaging than a standard dump and change.
That's the reality.
So how often do you actually need to succeed for carrying to be the right choice? Like, if I try to carry it in 10 times, how many times do I have to succeed for the math to say, yes, that was a good decision?
This is where we calculate the break-even point. If you are playing against a team of perfectly equal skill, you only need to be 34% confident that you can complete the carry for it to be the better mathematical bet than dumping it.
Let that sink in for a second. 34%.
It's remarkably low.
That means you can fail 2 out of 3 times. You can turn the puck over twice for every 1 time you succeed, and the math still screams that you should have tried to carry it. The threshold for risk is just incredibly low.
It really is. And of course, that 34% break-even point shifts dynamically based on the personnel on the ice.
How so?
Well, if you're a team's top scoring line with highly skilled players and you're attacking against the team's weakest defensive pair, your break-even point drops to 26%.
The math practically begs you to try.
Exactly. On the flip side, if you're a fourth-line grinding unit, maybe guys who don't have great hands, and you're attacking an elite defensive pair, your break-even point rises to 44%.
But even at 44% in the absolute worst-case matchup, you still don't even need a coin flip level of confidence to justify the attempt.
Exactly. You still only need to succeed less than half the time.
So the honest data-backed conclusion is that players were giving up the puck far too easily.
Oh, completely. The visual of a blue line turnover is embarrassing. So players sought the psychological safety of the dump in, but mathematically, that safety was a total illusion. It was slowly bleeding away their team's chances to win.
Okay, so let's lock in this first major concept. The mental model completely shifts here. Dump and chase is a tool, yes, and we will talk about how to use it properly later. But it is not the default safe haven.
Not at all.
Carrying a puck is worth twice as much offense, and the punishment for failing a carry is smaller than the punishment for a dump and change. You only need to think you have a roughly 1 in 3 chance of succeeding to make carrying the right statistical play.
And that data gives us our mandate. We absolutely must try to carry the puck in whenever possible. But wanting to carry it and actually doing it are two very different things.
Right, because now we run straight into a physical problem.
Exactly. We have to look at the physical boundary itself and the offside rule that governs it.
Because it's not just a free skate. You have this 12-inch physical boundary standing in your way. How do players legally cross that boundary at 20 miles an hour without blowing the play?
It's all about technique.
And I love this next part because it takes what seems like a limitation, the offside rule, and turns it into a tactical weapon.
To understand how to weaponize the rule, we have to understand exactly what the rule says. The offside rule dictates that no attacking player can cross the blue line into the offensive zone before the puck does.
If you do, the play is whistled dead.
Right. So if you are a winger without the puck and you are flying up the ice to support your teammate who is carrying the puck, you have a massive timing problem.
Because you want to enter the zone at your absolute maximum speed, so you're dangerous.
Exactly. But if you skate normally and you just happen to be half a stride ahead of the puck carrier, you will cross the line early and completely ruin the play.
And you can't just stop at the line and wait. Because then you have zero momentum and the defense will just swallow you up. So how do you arrive at max speed without crossing early?
You use a highly specific physical technique called the trail skate drag.
The trail skate drag.
Imagine you're that winger flying toward the attacking blue line. The puck is a few feet behind you. You attack the line at full speed, but you position yourself so your inside foot is leading.
Okay, inside foot leading.
As you reach the blue paint, you stop pushing with your trailing leg. You extend that trailing leg backward and let the skate blade glide, keeping it physically touching the blue paint of the line while your leading leg and your entire upper body continue forward into the zone.
And this is where the precise wording of the rule book creates a massive loophole. What exactly is the linesman judging when they decide if you are offside?
The linesman is judging your skates, not your body. The rule explicitly states that you are onside as long as one skate is in contact with the line, or on your own side of the line at the exact instant the puck completely crosses the leading edge.
And remember, the blue line is 12 inches wide.
Right. Any touch of that paint counts.
So think about the physics and geometry of this for a second. If I am in a deep lunge, dragging my back toe on that 12 inches of paint, my leading skate is already 3 feet into the offensive zone.
Yep.
My torso, my hands, and my stick stretched out in front of me might be 5 or 6 feet into the zone. I am fully extended, ready to receive a pass, occupying space inside the attacking zone. But legally, I have not entered the zone yet.
Exactly. Only that trailing blade is keeping you legal. And the instant the puck crosses the line behind you, you snap that trailing blade off the paint, bring it forward, and push off into the zone.
So because your center of mass is already moving forward, you hit the zone at maximum velocity, already in a dangerous position.
That's the beauty of it.
But wait, I have to throw a massive safety override in here. Let's think about the reality of the ice. If my body, my hands, and my stick are already crossing the plane of the blue line while I drag my toe, I am physically entering space that a defending player might already be occupying.
Oh, absolutely.
A defenseman might be standing right on the other side of that line, waiting to hit me. My body is arriving before my skates do, therefore my head absolutely must be up.
That is completely non-negotiable. You cannot drag that trail skate while looking down at your feet to see if you are on the paint.
Or looking backward over your shoulder at the puck.
Right. Aggressive body position under the offside rule is a massive tactical advantage, but the physical reality of the sport does not care what the rule book says. You are arriving at top speed.
If your head is down, you cannot brace for a collision, and a surprised body does not absorb contact well.
You're setting yourself up for a devastating injury.
And this brings up a fascinating nuance. We have listeners who play, coach, or watch hockey under different rule books all over the world. Does this trail skate drag work exactly the same way everywhere? Because I know the NHL made a major change to this a few years ago.
This is a crucial detail for anyone applying this mental model. The technique works conceptually everywhere, but the exact legality of that trailing skate varies wildly depending on which rulebook governs your game.
How so?
Well, in the NHL and under the IIHF rulebook, which governs the Olympics, the World Championships, and all levels of hockey in places like the UK and Europe, that trailing skate does not even have to touch the ice.
Wait, really? It can be in the air?
Yes. The NHL and IIHF rulebooks state that the blue line is a vertical plane extending upwards from the ice.
Oh, wow.
So if you're doing the trail skate drag, you can literally lift your trailing skate in the air, hold it back over the neutral zone so it breaks that vertical plane, and you are perfectly onside. You don't have to worry about the friction of the blade catching the ice.
Okay, but what if I am playing high school hockey in Minnesota or junior hockey in Ontario?
Then you are playing a completely different game when it comes to the blue line. Under USA Hockey rules and Hockey Canada rules, the vertical plane does not exist for the trailing skate.
So it has to be down.
The skate must be in physical, tangible contact with the ice. If your trail skate is even a millimeter airborne as the puck crosses the line, you are offside. Period.
Why the difference? Why would the amateur rules be stricter than the NHL?
It really comes down to safety and control. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada determined that allowing players to leap into the zone with their back leg flying in the air was leading to dangerous, uncontrolled collisions.
Ah, that makes sense.
By forcing the player to keep the skate on the ice, it forces them to stay grounded and in better physical control of their trajectory. So if you play under those two books, you must master the edge control to keep that trailing blade gliding physically on the paint without catching an edge and wiping out.
So we try the entry, we use the trail skate drag, but hockey is a game of inches, and sometimes the timing just gets messed up. Someone crosses early, we are officially offside.
It happens all the time.
The linesman's arm goes up, signaling the infraction, but they don't blow the whistle immediately. This is the delayed offside. And I think this specific scenario is where a lot of players, especially young players, make a massive, incredibly dangerous mistake.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's walk through this. I'm an attacking forward. The puck gets chipped in, but we are offside. The delayed offside arm goes up. The opposing defenseman turns his back to me to skate back into the corner and retrieve the loose puck.
Right.
If the puck is right there in the corner, human instinct tells me to just go hit the defenseman, force a turnover, and take it. Why shouldn't I?
You absolutely cannot do that. It is a massive penalty risk, and it is arguably one of the most dangerous plays in the sport.
Really?
Yes. The danger stems from a widespread misunderstanding of what actually causes the linesman to blow the whistle and stop the play during a delayed offside.
Walk us through the mechanics of the whistle then.
Under the NHL and IIHF rules, the linesman will blow the whistle the instant an attacking player touches the puck. Or, crucially, if an attacking player is about to make physical contact with the defending puck carrier.
Okay, so in the pros, if you barrel down on that defenseman, the linesman will usually blow the whistle right before you hit him, basically saving you from yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, but what about the amateur rules? USA Hockey and Hockey Canada.
This is the trap. Under USA Hockey and Hockey Canada, there is no whistle for about to make contact.
Wait, really?
The rule states the whistle only blows when the attacking team actually touches the puck. There is no rule that says the linesman will blow the whistle to save you before you hit the guy.
Oh, wow. So the play is legally still completely live as I am bearing down on a defenseman who thinks the play is basically over.
Yes, the play does not stop just because you are closing in aggressively. And here's where it becomes a catastrophe. That defenseman has turned to retrieve the puck. His back is to you.
And he's probably a few feet away from the board.
Exactly. If you hit him, you are hitting him from behind into the boards. And the North American rule books are utterly merciless on this for very good medical reasons.
Because hitting someone from behind into the boards is how spinal injuries happen.
Exactly. Under USA Hockey, forcefully checking an opponent from behind into the boards is not a minor two-minute penalty. It is an automatic major penalty plus a game misconduct or a match penalty.
So you're gone.
You are ejected from the game immediately. Under Hockey Canada, a hit from behind anywhere on the ice, even in open ice, is a minor plus a game misconduct, meaning your night is over.
And if it's into the boards?
If the referee deems it violent or into the boards, it's a major and a game misconduct, even if nobody is actually hurt.
So to make this crystal clear for our mental model, when that delayed offside arm goes up, you never, ever hunt the defenseman.
Never.
It is not a free opportunity to lay a big hit. What is the actual correct protocol for clearing the zone?
You must instantly abandon the puck and retreat to the blue line to tag up. And tagging up means making actual physical skate contact with the blue line.
Wait, remember that vertical plane rule we discussed earlier for the NHL? Does that apply here?
It does not apply here. The IIHF rulebook explicitly states 3D judgment is not used in this situation. You cannot hover your foot over the line. You have to touch the physical paint.
And it's not just one person, right? The whole team has to sync up.
Crucial point. Every single attacking player must be completely clear of the zone at the same exact instant. If four players touch the line and tag up, but one guy is being lazy and is still dragging his skates inside the zone, the delayed offside remains in effect.
So even if the first four guys re-enter, they are still offside because of the fifth guy.
Exactly. You have to communicate verbally. You have to shout, get everyone out, make sure everyone touches the paint simultaneously. And then and only then can you re-enter to attack.
Let's do a quick recap to solidify what we just covered.
Sounds good.
The physical blue line is a tool, not just a barrier. We use the trail skate drag to arrive exactly on time at maximum speed. But we must know if our specific rulebook requires the blade physically on the ice or allows it to break the vertical plane in the air.
Spot on.
And if we get the timing wrong and trigger a delayed offside, we instantly retreat, communicate, and tag up. We never hunt or hit a turning defenseman because under amateur rules, the whistle will not blow to save us, and a hit from behind will get us instantly ejected.
That perfectly encapsulates the rules of the boundary.
Yeah.
But now that we know why we want to carry the puck and we know how to legally cross the line without being offside, we have to look at the physical tactical execution.
Right.
We have to figure out how to physically beat the large humans who are actively trying to stop us.
Yes, the art of the carry-in. We want to carry it, we're onside, but we have defenders in our way. How do we physically beat them?
Let's start with a one-on-one scenario.
Okay. When I think about a defenseman skating backward to defend the rush, I always picture a door with a rusty hinge.
I like that.
They are solid, imposing, and strong when they're facing you squarely, but their absolute weakest mechanical moment is when they have to pivot, when they have to transition their weight from backward crossovers to forward skating, or when they have to open their hips to turn.
That rusty hinge analogy is perfect.
Yeah.
Because it highlights the biomechanics. A defenseman skating backward has excellent lateral mobility as long as they stay square. But the moment they have to rotate their pelvis to track a player moving wide, they lose the ability to push effectively in the opposite direction. And that biomechanical weakness gives us our first tactical concept for the puck carrier.
Which is?
Attack the outside shoulder.
The outside shoulder being the shoulder closest to the sideboards. Why there?
Because a defender's primary overriding job is to protect the middle of the ice, the direct path to the net. If you, as the puck carrier, drive your skating route straight at their outside shoulder with speed, you force them into a dilemma.
They have to make a choice.
Exactly. They want to keep you to the outside. But to physically cover that outside lane and maintain their speed, they have to open their hips toward the boards. That is the rusty hinge moment. The instant their hips open outward, their center of gravity commits them to that direction.
And the moment they commit to the outside, a new lane magically opens up on their inside.
Exactly. Because their hips are facing the boards, they cannot physically explode back toward the center of the ice. So the instant they open up, you cut back to the middle.
You can just slip the puck between their feet.
Or pass it to a teammate who is driving down the center. You aren't necessarily trying to outskate them in a straight line. You are manipulating their biomechanics to force them to commit their hips to the wrong direction.
But what if they're smart? What if they refuse to take the bait? They stay perfectly square to the middle and refuse to open their hips.
Well, if they refuse to defend the outside lane, you just take the outside lane. You take what they give you. You drive down the wall all the way to the goal line.
Simple enough.
But this brings up a much more complex problem. You are rarely attacking just one defender. Usually there are two defensemen and maybe a back-checking forward. What do you do when facing multiple defenders?
The mental model tells us we must attack the seam. Let's unpack that. What exactly is a seam and why is it so powerful?
A seam is the open, empty space directly between two defending players. It could be the space between the left and right defenseman, or the space between a defenseman and a forward who is skating back to help. The absolute golden rule of entering the zone against multiple players is that you should never skate directly at a single defender.
Why? That seems like the most direct path.
Because if you skate right at one guy, you have given his brain an incredibly easy job. He has zero ambiguity. His only job is to stop the guy coming right at him.
He doesn't have to think.
Exactly. But if you skate into the seam between two players, you create a localized crisis of communication. You force both of their brains to process a split-second decision. Both defenders look at you, and both have to ask themselves, do I step up and hit him, or do I stay in my lane and let my partner take him?
It's like a pop fly in baseball that goes right between the shortstop and the left fielder. They look at each other for a fraction of a second, thinking, you got it, no, I got it, and they both hesitate.
Precisely. And in hockey, at 20 miles an hour, that half second of hesitation is all you need to blow right past them. Or, even better, you force them to make a mistake.
Like stepping out of position.
Yes. If one of the defenders decides to step out of his lane and attack you in the seam, he has just vacated his defensive space, which means one of your teammates is now wide open in the area that defender just left. By attacking the seam, you force one defender to make a choice, which instantly creates a two-on-one advantage somewhere else on the ice.
But doing this effectively requires teammates. You can't just weave through three guys by yourself while your teammates watch. This is where support routes and decoys come in.
Oh, absolutely.
And I want to spend some real time on this because I think it is the most misunderstood part of hockey strategy. Let's talk about the middle drive.
The middle drive is perhaps the most selfless, exhausting, and tactically important route in the sport.
How does it work?
It involves a player who does not have the puck. They start in the neutral zone, and they skate at absolute maximum speed straight through the center of the ice, right through the seam between the defensemen, heading directly for the opposing goalie.
And here is the secret that I think shocks casual fans. The middle driver usually has absolutely no expectation of getting the puck.
None. They are essentially a human decoy.
So why on earth would a player sprint 100 feet, burning all their energy, to go to the most dangerous part of the ice if they know they aren't getting a pass?
Because you are freezing the defense. Think about it from the defenseman's perspective. You have the puck carrier coming down the sidewall, but you also have a 200-pound forward skating at full speed directly down the middle of the ice towards your goalie.
You can't just ignore that.
You cannot ignore the middle driver. If you ignore them and the puck carrier actually does pass it, it's an automatic tap-in goal. So the defensemen have to respect the drive. They have to back off their gap, retreat toward their own net, and physically cover that middle driver.
And by forcing the defenseman to retreat and cover the middle, they are physically incapable of stepping up to hit the actual puck carrier on the wall.
Exactly. That one player running that one route at full speed acts like a snowplow. They push the defense deep into the zone, literally buying the puck carrier 20 or 30 square feet of wide-open ice right at the blue line.
The entire entry succeeds because of the guy who never touched the puck.
It's beautiful to watch when it works.
But it only works if it is believable.
It must be totally committed.
Yeah.
If you do a half-hearted middle drive, if you just kind of glide over the blue line and drift lazily into the slot, you aren't freezing anyone. The defenseman will look at you, realize you aren't a threat, and turn their attention right back to the puck carrier. You have to look terrifying to the defense.
Okay, safety override again. Driving the middle seam means you are entering the one area of the ice, the high slot, where two different defensemen can hit you from different angles.
It's a dangerous neighborhood.
You are a target, so your head must be up. What does the rule book say about getting hit when you are running a decoy route like this?
It is a very nuanced area of the rules, particularly when it comes to head contact. Let's look at the IIHF rule book, for instance. The IIHF is incredibly strict on headshots. The rule specifically states that there is no such thing as a clean check to the head or neck. However, the rule book explicitly carves out an exception regarding the posture of the player being hit. It declines to heavily penalize a defender for a square horizontal check with no upward motion if the attacking player is skating with their head down.
Meaning, if you are admiring your own skates while running the middle drive, you basically forfeit your rule book protection.
Correct. The responsibility for safety is shared. But if your head is up, the rule says the opponent does not have the right to hit you in the head or neck, whether you have the puck or not. Keeping your head on a swivel, scanning for both defenders, is the absolute condition of surviving a middle drive.
Let's also quickly touch on wide entries and setting picks, because they are crucial support mechanisms. If I'm the puck carrier and I go wide down the boards, I need that middle drive so I have a passing option, but I also need someone high in the zone.
Going wide alone without support is just a slow dump in.
Right. But what about picks? In basketball, setting a screen is a fundamental play. In hockey, it's called interference. How do players navigate that?
It requires theatrical precision. In hockey, you cannot deliberately stop, stand still, or step into a defender's path to block them while you do not have the puck. That is an automatic 2-minute penalty for interference.
So what can you do?
Well, you are entitled to the ice you are skating on. So players execute what are essentially moving picks. You skate a route that purposely crosses the path of a defender. You have to look exactly like you were going somewhere specific to receive a pass.
So if they hit you, it's their fault.
Right. If the defender happens to accidentally run into the traffic you created while you're legitimately skating your route, it is totally legal. But the moment you brace for impact or alter your path just to hit them, your team is going to the penalty box.
Okay, so we have all these moving parts. We have the puck carrier attacking the shoulder. We have the middle driver running the decoy route. We have the wide support setting moving picks. How do we synchronize this? Because timing is everything.
It's a ballet.
Let's think about the approach. If you are listening to this, you might be thinking, if speed is the goal, why not just get to the blue line as fast as humanly possible? But arriving early to the blue line is actually a massive trap, isn't it?
It is the most common mistake young players make. If you sprint and arrive at the blue line before the play develops, you have to stop or heavily decelerate to stay onside while waiting for the puck.
And a stationary player is easy to defend.
A stationary player in hockey is completely useless. You have zero kinetic energy, you are incredibly easy to defend, and you cannot accelerate fast enough to beat a moving defenseman.
So you actually have to manage your speed.
Yes. The counterintuitive truth of zone entries is that arriving with maximum speed often requires you to skate slower in the neutral zone. You might coast 30 feet out so that you can begin hard crossovers and hit peak acceleration at the exact moment you cross the line.
And regarding the synchronization of all three players, who should cross the line first?
Mathematically and tactically, the puck carrier should actually be the last player to hit the blue line. You want the carrier to be half a stride to a full stride behind the two wingers who are running the middle drive and the wide support.
That seems entirely backwards. Shouldn't the guy with the puck lead the charge into enemy territory?
Think about the geometry of the defense. If the puck carrier arrives first, the two support players are trapped behind the play in the neutral zone.
Oh, I see.
The entire defensive structure can just collapse onto the one guy with the puck, knowing he has no passing options yet. But if the wingers hit the line, first one driving hard to the middle, one going wide, the defense has to instantly scatter and retreat to cover those two threats.
And then the puck carrier crosses.
Exactly. When the puck carrier crosses a fraction of a second later, The defensive structure is already pulled apart, stretched deep into the zone, leaving massive pockets of open ice for the carrier to exploit.
Incredible. So let's synthesize the art of the carrion. We attack the seams to isolate defenders and force hesitation. We attack the outside shoulder to force the defender's hips to open to the boards.
Yep.
We use a full speed, fully committed middle drive to freeze the defense and buy space, ensuring our head is up. And we synchronize our timing so that the puck carrier is the last to arrive at the line, hitting it at absolute peak acceleration.
That is the perfect physical execution when everything goes right. But hockey is a game of chaos and friction. What happens when the perfect timing fails?
Right.
You hit the line, but your wingers got tied up, hooked, or blocked in the neutral zone. You cross the blue line, and you're all alone against two massive defensemen.
And this brings us to the most psychologically difficult tactic in our mental model, the tactics of delay and misdirection. I have to admit, everything in my competitive brain pushes back on this concept.
It's hard to do.
When I am driving toward the opponent's net, the idea of stopping, turning my back, and skating the wrong way feels like I am admitting defeat. It feels like a retreat.
It absolutely runs against human instinct. Our instinct, particularly the amateur instinct, is to force the issue. Most wasted entries happen because a player arrives alone at the blue line, feels the pressure of the moment, and feels they have to make a hero play.
Try to dangle through everyone.
Right. They try to stick handle through two defensemen, or they throw a weak, hopeful shot at the net from 40 feet away.
And the analytics tell us, what about those hero plays?
The analytics show us that a forced, unsupported entry is a dead end. It almost always results in an instant turnover and a transition the other way. This is where the delay, or the curlback, becomes a superpower. It is the ability to suppress your instinct to force a bad play.
So how do you physically execute a delay?
You cross the blue line, you read the situation, and you realize you have no support. Instead of forcing it, you hit the brakes. You turn away from the defensive pressure, curling your path back toward the blue line you just crossed.
Just loop right back.
You keep your body positioned firmly between the oncoming defender and the puck to protect it. You look back up the ice into the neutral zone to see where your teammates are, and you intentionally slow the play down, killing 1 or 2 seconds of clock.
And why does killing those 2 seconds magically fix the play?
Because it takes a broken, mathematically doomed play and resets it into a controlled entry. Those 1 or 2 seconds of delay are exactly how long it takes your late teammates to arrive at the blue line at full speed.
Yeah.
Furthermore, as you curl back toward the blue line, you often drag an aggressive defender with you. That movement stretches the defensive zone. It pulls the defenseman out of position, creating a massive pocket of open ice behind them for your arriving teammates to skate into. You turn a failed entry into a highly dangerous offensive setup.
But there is a massive safety override here. I cannot stress this enough. Where can you absolutely never, ever execute this curl back maneuver?
You must never curl against the wall. The delay maneuver is strictly designed for open ice. If you are skating hard down the sideboards, with a defender closing in right behind you, and you suddenly hit the brakes and turn your back to them to protect the puck, you have just put yourself in the most physically dangerous position in the sport.
Because you have intentionally turned your back to an oncoming checker right next to the immovable board.
Exactly. You just converted a standard legal body check into a catastrophic hit from behind.
Yeah.
And the medical data on this specific collision is terrifying.
Yeah, let's get into that.
If you are hit from behind into the boards, particularly if your instinct is to brace for impact by ducking your head and tucking your chin, it straightens the natural curve of the cervical spine. A head-first collision in that posture does not even require high speed to cause a severe spinal cord injury.
It's terrifying.
It can literally happen at walking speed if the spine is loaded actually in that straightened position.
So let's run this scenario. I am trapped on the wall. I cross the line. I have no support. The defender has a tight gap. And I cannot safely turn back because I'm on the boards. What do I do?
You take the hit safely to make the play. You keep your skates parallel to the wall. You lean into the impending contact with your forearm and your hip. You keep your head up and you keep your chin off your chest.
Just brace properly.
You absorb the check and try to pin the puck against the boards with your skates to wait for help. Protecting the puck or trying to salvage the entry never, ever justifies risking your spinal cord. Only use the delay in open ice.
That is a phenomenal point that transcends analytics. Okay, what about the other misdirection tactic? The drop pass.
Well, this is a classic.
We see this all the time on the power play. The puck carrier skates in, suddenly leaves the puck sitting dead on the ice behind him, and a trailing teammate scoops it up. but it seems like it goes wrong half the time and looks ridiculous. What are the mechanical secrets of a good drop pass?
There are three critical mechanics to understand. First, you must drop the puck to a space, not to a stick.
What does that mean?
It means you do not try to pass it backward directly onto your teammate's blade. You are simply leaving the puck stationary, or slightly rolling, in an empty, predefined area of ice for the receiver to skate onto. It is like a relay race baton handoff, but the baton is left hovering in space.
Got it. Second mechanic.
The player dropping the puck must continue driving hard toward the net as a decoy after they leave the puck behind.
So they can't just stop.
Right. If you drop the puck and then just stand up and coast, the defense instantly knows you don't have it. They shift their eyes to the trailing player. But if you drop it and violently accelerate toward the net, you drag a defender with you. You create the open ice for the trailer.
And the third mechanic.
Speed differential. The entire play relies on the trailing player moving significantly faster than the defense is capable of adjusting backward.
So what is the most common misconception? Why does it look so incredibly bad when an amateur team messes it up?
Because players use it as a panic reflex instead of a calculated read. They cross the line, realize they are in trouble, panic, and blindly shovel the puck backward without looking to see if anyone is there.
Just hoping someone is behind them.
Exactly. Dropping the puck blind with no trailer in sight and no speed differential results in a stationary puck sitting in the middle of the ice, perfectly teed up for the opponent while your entire team is moving the wrong way.
It's the worst turnover.
It is arguably the worst turnover in hockey. The golden rule: if you cannot explicitly see your support player, do not drop the puck.
Let's recap the section on misdirection. The power of pausing. We can turn a broken play into a controlled entry using the delay as long as we do it in open ice and never, ever against the boards where spinal injuries occur.
Crucial point.
And we can use the drop pass to exploit speed differentials, provided we drop the puck to a space, continue driving as a decoy, and never do it blindly.
Which brings us to a harsh reality of the game. Sometimes, despite the math telling us to carry the puck, and despite having all these tools like the delay and the drop pass, the defensive gap is just too tight.
And just play it perfectly.
The defenders have played it perfectly. You have absolutely no support, and you cannot safely curl back. You cannot carry it. You have to dump the puck in.
Right. Strategic surrender, dump-ins, and chasing.
I love the framing here because dumping the puck isn't just wildly firing it into the corner in a panic and hoping for the best.
It shouldn't be anyway.
It is a calculated, precise pass to an empty space. And there isn't just one way to do it. The outline identifies five progressive types of dump-ins, each designed to solve a specific physical problem on the ice. Let's walk through them in detail.
The first and most common is the hard rim. You use this when a defender is pressuring you tightly from the inside lane, cutting off your path to the middle, but you see one of your teammates flying down the far wall on the other side of the ice.
So you fire the puck low and incredibly hard around the curvature of the boards.
So the puck rides the wall all the way around behind the net.
Exactly. It uses the boards to bypass the defender stepping up on you, and because it is traveling so fast, it arrives on the far side before the other defenseman can rotate over to intercept it. Your teammate picks it up in stride.
It's essentially a 50-foot bank pass. Okay, what is type two?
The soft airy dump. This is a completely different philosophy.
Yeah.
This is all about engineering a foot race you know you can win. Instead of firing it hard, you place the puck gently into the near corner so that it just dies there.
You don't want it ringing around the boards.
You want it sitting still.
Why?
Because your forechecker, your teammate who is chasing the puck, is already moving forward at top speed. The defending player has to stop, pivot, turn their back to the play, and skate backward to retrieve a dead puck from a standstill.
That's a huge disadvantage.
You are forcing them to generate their own momentum while a 200-pound forward is bearing down on them. It creates massive psychological and physical pressure on the defender.
That makes total sense. Type three.
The chip pass to stepping defenseman. I love this one because it is actually a possession play disguised as a dump-in. If a defender commits early, meaning they aggressively step up at the blue line to try and hit you just lightly lift or push the puck into the space right behind them, down the wall.
Because they are moving forward to hit you, their momentum takes them completely out of the play once the puck is behind them.
Precisely. They cannot stop and turn fast enough. You instantly slip around them, absorb the glancing contact, and collect your own chip pass. You use their aggression against them.
It's like a matador stepping aside. I like that. What about the fourth?
The cross-corner dump. This is pure geometry. Imagine you are on the right side of the ice, but the right corner is heavily defended. You shoot the puck diagonally across the zone, hard into the far left corner.
What does that accomplish?
It forces the opponent's weak side defenseman to go get it. That defenseman now has a long, awkward retrieval. They have to skate toward their own end boards to get a puck on their backhand side, which means they are facing the glass, entirely blind to the play behind them.
Oh, that's nasty.
And while they are doing that, your far side winger is flying in on a direct linear path to hit them. It is designed to create an incredibly difficult mechanical and visual situation for the defender.
And the final type, the flip.
The flip is used against specific defensive systems, like a 1-3-1 trap. When the opposing team clogs the neutral zone by lining up three players shoulder to shoulder across the red line to form a literal wall, you don't try to skate through it.
What do?
You open the blade of your stick like a wedge in golf, and you lob the puck high into the air, 20 feet off the ice, right over the heads of the three-man wall. You land it softly in the open ice behind them for your forwards to skate onto. It bypasses the structure entirely.
So we have five tactical ways to dump it, but where exactly on the ice should we aim? Because there are specific rules governing the goaltender that totally dictate the geometry of a dump-in. Let's talk about the trapezoid rule.
Yeah, the goalie's playpen.
Right. I like to think of the trapezoid painted behind the net as just that. Can you explain the history and the mechanics of this?
It is often referred to informally as the Martin Brodeur rule. Years ago, goalies like Brodeur were so incredibly good at handling the puck that any time a team dumped it in, he would skate into the corner, retrieve it, and pass it out, completely neutralizing the forecheck.
It must have been infuriating for the offense.
It slowed the game down to a crawl. So the NHL painted a trapezoidal area behind the net. The rule is strictly enforced. The goalie cannot play the puck outside of those lines behind the goal line.
If they do.
If a goalie touches the puck in the corners, it is an automatic 2-minute penalty for delay of game. Therefore, the corners are legally out of bounds for the goalie, but the area directly behind the net, inside the trapezoid, is safe for them.
So tactically, what does that mean for our dump-ins?
It means you must aim your dump-ins specifically into the corners. If you miscalculate and dump the puck straight down the middle so it lands directly behind the net inside the trapezoid, the goalie will just casually stop it, set it up perfectly for their defenseman on a silver platter, and you have wasted your possession.
But if you put it in the corner, the goalie is paralyzed.
Exactly. They cannot touch it. A defenseman has to go retrieve it under heavy pressure.
Okay, quick rule book check. Does every league have a trapezoid?
No. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada rulebooks do not have a trapezoid. Their goalies are free to wander the corners to play the puck.
Okay, so that changes things for amateurs.
However, they still cannot freeze the puck under their glove in the corners to stop play without getting a penalty. They have to keep it moving. So even in North American amateur hockey, dumping to the corners is smart because it forces a chaotic retrieval by a goalie who usually isn't a great stick handler.
Right, and that brings us to the second half of the equation, the actual chase. Dumping is only half the job. You have to go win the puck back. And the fundamental principle here is angle, don't chase straight. What does that mean mechanically?
The biggest tactical mistake amateurs make on a forecheck is skating in a straight line directly at the puck or the defender. That just shortens the distance, but it leaves all the defender's passing lanes open.
So what's the alternative?
Instead, you need to pursue on an angle. You skate your route to a point between the retrieving defender and their easiest escape route.
You are steering them.
Exactly. You want to cut off their ability to turn up the sideboards. You take away the easy play, forcing them to turn backward or make a hard panic pass on their backhand into the chaotic middle of the ice. That is where turnovers happen.
And there is a highly structured system for this chase, right? Players talk about F1, F2, F3. How does that structure work?
These are roles defined by who arrives at the puck first, not by your printed position on the roster. F1 is simply the first player in on the forecheck. Their primary job isn't necessarily to steal the puck. Their job is to apply immediate, violent pressure, force a hurried decision, and take away that easy escape route.
They are the disruptor.
Yes. Then comes F2, the second player in. F2's job is to read the chaos that F1 just caused. They watch where F1 is steering the defender, and they swoop in to intercept the panic pass or collect the loose puck. F1 creates the turnover. F2 collects the reward.
And F3?
F3 stays high in the offensive zone, usually around the top of the faceoff circles. They act as the safety valve. If the forecheck fails and the other team breaks out, F3 is in position to instantly transition to defense and prevent a counterattack.
And one final safety rule on the chase. If you dump it in and the goalie actually does come out of the crease to play the puck, you cannot hit them, right? Even if they are acting like a defenseman.
Never. A goalie is never, ever fair game outside their crease. The rule books are highly protective. Under Hockey Canada rules, for example, charging or hitting a goalie who is outplaying the puck is an automatic major penalty and a game misconduct ejection.
Good to know.
You angle the puck, you try to intercept the pass, but you do not hit the goalie.
Let's do a comprehensive review of strategic surrender. Dumping the puck is a precise tactical strike to space, not a panic move. We use rims, soft areas, chips, cross corners, or flips depending on the defense. We always aim for the corners to keep the puck away from the goalie's trapezoid. And we use a structured, angled chase with F1 forcing the error, F2 collecting the puck, and F3 playing safety.
Which brings us to the ultimate cognitive challenge of the sport. We now have an entire toolbox of mental models. We know the math favors carrying. We know how to use the trail skate drag.
Right.
We know how to attack seams and use middle drives. We know how to delay in open ice. And we know exactly how to execute 5 different dump-ins. But here's the reality. A hockey player is skating 20 miles an hour. They have exactly half a second to choose which of these tools to use as they approach that 12-inch blue line.
How does the human brain process that decision?
This is where we build the real-time decision matrix.
The algorithm.
Exactly.
I love this part because we are breaking down a split-second athletic instinct into a logical flowchart. What is the 4-step checklist going through an elite player's brain as they cross the red line?
It happens almost subconsciously through repetition, but the algorithm is very clear. Step 1, evaluate the gap.
The distance between the puck carrier and the nearest defender.
Exactly. The player scans the ice. If it's a large gap, meaning the defender is backed way off, conceding the blue line, the decision tree stops right there. The decision is easy. Carry the puck. Take the free ice the defender is giving you.
But if it's tight?
If it's a normal gap, say 2 to 3 stick lengths, you have to make a move. You plan to attack their outside shoulder or use a middle drive to push them back. But if the gap is incredibly tight, the defender is right in your face, standing up at the red line carrying is mathematically a low percentage risk. You instantly shift your mindset to a chip past them, a delay, or a dump in.
Okay, so step 1 is gap. Assuming the gap allows for a potential entry, what is step 2?
Step 2, evaluate support. Do you have teammates crossing the line with you at speed? If yes, carry the puck and attack the seams. If you look and see you have one teammate but they're a second late, you execute the delay curlback to buy them that second of time.
And if no one is there?
If you scan and realize you have absolutely nobody with you, you're completely isolated, you cannot carry your delay. You have to dump the puck to a space.
Makes total sense. Gap dictates possibility. Support dictates the tactic. What is step 3?
Step 3, score and time. This is the one place where the rigid analytics bend to game theory. If the game is tied or it's early in the first period, you play the math. You try to carry the puck because we know it creates double the offense.
But if you're winning?
If you are protecting a 1-goal lead with 2 minutes left in the third period, a blue line turnover is a catastrophic risk that could cost you the game. The math shifts. You dump it deep, set up a forecheck, and burn the clock in the safest area of the ice.
And if you're losing?
Conversely, if you're losing late, you carry at all costs, even against a tight gap, because a dump-in is just surrendering possession that you desperately need to score.
Gap, support, score, and time. And the final filter in the algorithm.
Step 4, who you are. The physical personnel on the ice heavily influences the decision. If you are an elite first-line scoring unit going against a tired, slow, fourth-line defensive pairing, you should try to carry the puck on almost every single entry.
Because the probability massively favors your skill.
Right. But if you are a grinding defensive fourth line facing an elite Norris Trophy defensive pair, your threshold for risk is much lower. You simply don't have the hands to beat them consistently. You will rely much more heavily on dump-ins and physical forechecking to wear them down.
Let's cement this algorithm for the listener. The entire decision matrix boils down to this flow carry. If the gap gives you open ice and you have team support, chip it if the defender commits early, delay in open ice if your support is just a second behind, and dump it only to a space a teammate is already skating to or if the clock demands it.
That is the perfect mental algorithm for an attacking player. It takes all the chaos we've discussed and distills it into actionable logic.
Yeah.
But to truly master this entire concept, we cannot just look at it from the offensive side.
Right, because someone is trying to stop you.
If you want to understand how a system works, you have to look at how people try to break it. We have to flip the board. How do defenders try to ruin everything we just learned?
Welcome to Defending the Entry. Seeing the game through the eyes of the enemy, how do they physically stop the carrion?
Everything a defender does starts with the exact opposite of what the attacker wants, gap control. A defender wants to absolutely dictate the attacker's speed. To do that, they try to maintain a gap of roughly 2 to 3 stick lengths in the neutral zone, moving backward at the exact same speed the attacker is moving forward.
So they're mirroring them.
Exactly. As they approach the blue line, the defender violently accelerates backward to shrink that gap down to exactly 1 stick length right at the paint. If they maintain that perfect, suffocating gap, they eliminate the time and space required to carry, forcing the attacker into a low percentage dump-in or an outright turnover.
And they don't just do this individually. They use physical, coordinated team structures. The outline lists 3 main defensive postures used to defend the blue line. Let's walk through them.
The first and most aggressive is standing up at the line. Instead of skating backward to match speed, the defensemen skate forward to the blue line, plant their feet, and refuse to give up the boundary.
That seems risky.
This is a high-risk, high-reward structure. If it works, it completely kills a controlled carry-in. It forces a collision or an instant dump.
But the risk?
The risk is catastrophic. If the attacker anticipates it and chips the puck past them, the defensemen have 0 backward momentum. They are flat-footed, and the attacker blows by them for a clean breakaway. It's an all-or-nothing gamble.
What's the second structure?
Forcing wide, which coaches often call receiving the entry. In this structure, the defensemen stay between the face-off dots in the middle of the ice, prioritizing the protection of the center lane over everything else.
They just concede the blue line?
They essentially concede the blue line. They allow the attacker to carry the puck in, but by clogging the middle, they force the attacker to the outside walls. It is a philosophy of containment. Let them enter, but keep them in the least dangerous areas of the ice.
Conceding the yard to protect the house, and the third structure, the squash and slide.
This is a highly aggressive, modern tactical structure, heavily popularized by defensive coaches like Bruce Cassidy in the NHL. Imagine a foosball table where the little plastic men are attached to a metal bar and can only slide side to side together.
Okay, I have the visual.
The two defensemen hold the exact same depth on the ice and slide horizontally across the ice together, maintaining their spacing like they are on a foosball bar. As the attacker comes down the right wing, both defensemen slide hard to the right.
So they trap him.
The near defenseman physically squashes the puck carrier against the wall right at the blue line. Simultaneously, the far defenseman slides all the way over to the middle to cover any passes.
But wait, if both defensemen slide to the right, doesn't that leave the entire left side of the ice completely wide open?
Yes, it does. And that is the genius and the vulnerability of the system. The crucial element here is the third man, the back-checking forward. It is their absolute non-negotiable responsibility to skate hard back into the defensive zone and cover that wide-open weak side. If the defensemen execute the squash, but that forward is lazy and doesn't back check, the attacker can just slip a pass across the ice to a teammate who is staring at an empty net. The squash and slide requires perfect 5-man synchronization.
And what about defending that delayed offside trap we talked about earlier? We know the attackers have to clear the zone, but what is the mental model for the defender retrieving the puck?
This is a critical rulebook nuance that catches defenders by surprise. If the attacking team is offside, you are the defender retrieving the puck. You know they cannot touch it. You know you are safe.
So you let your guard down.
So you collect the puck and look to make an outlet pass. The moment that puck leaves your stick, the moment you make the pass, you are no longer considered the defending puck carrier.
Meaning what?
Meaning any special rulebook protections you had against being hit instantly vanish. You are now just a regular player on the ice. If an attacking player has tagged up at the blue line and re-entered the zone, just as you make that pass, they can legally hit you.
Ouch.
Defenders often relax, thinking the play is dead because of the delayed offside, and they get absolutely leveled the second they move the puck because they forgot to keep their head up.
Okay, a quick review of defending the entry. It is all about dictating gap and speed to force the attacker into bad decisions. Teams use structures like standing up to aggressively kill plays, forcing wide to conservatively protect the middle, or the squash and slide to violently trap the puck on the boards with coordinated back-checking help.
Exactly. We have explored every angle of this 12-inch boundary. We have covered the foundational math, the rulebook geometry, the physical execution, the misdirection tactics, the dumping strategies, the cognitive decision matrix, and the defensive countermeasures.
We have built the complete mental model.
We really have.
Let's bring it all home with our final mastery review. We want to synthesize all of this into a unified theory of the zone entry so that our listeners can retain this, recall it, and see the game completely differently the next time they watch. How do we pull all these threads together?
It starts by redefining what the blue line is. It is not just paint. It is a mathematical and spatial boundary. Your ultimate goal is to cross it with physical control of the puck, because doing so literally doubles your offensive output compared to dumping it in.
Right.
You achieve this controlled entry not by brute force, but by manipulating the defense's momentum.
Right.
Attacking their outside shoulders to open their hips, exploiting the seams between them to cause hesitation, and using full-speed middle drives to freeze them in place.
And leveraging the rules.
Yes. You use physical tools like the trail skate drag to manipulate the offside rule, arriving at peak speed while staying legally onside.
And if that initial plan breaks down because the defense plays it perfectly,
you manage risk. You suppress the human instinct to force a bad play. You use the delay in open ice to wait for support. You never curl against the wall to protect your spine.
And if you have to dump it.
If the algorithm dictates that you absolutely must dump the puck, it is never a panic move. It is a calculated strike to a specific corner, intentionally avoiding the goalie's trapezoid, followed immediately by a coordinated angled chase. The entire system, offense and defense, is about creating, exploiting, or denying tiny advantages in time and space.
Let me give you, the listener, the absolute top takeaways. If you are trying to master this subject and explain it to someone else, remember these five core principles. Number one, the math is clear. A failed carry is mathematically better for your team than a tired dump and change. Fear the dump in, not the carry.
Great summary.
Number two, master the physics of the trail skate drag to cross the line at maximum velocity, but know exactly what your specific rule book says regarding airborne skates. Number three, the puck carrier must be the last one to hit the line. Let your support players stretch the defense deep into the zone first.
Timing is everything.
Number four, delay in open ice to buy time, but never ever turn your back against the boards. And number five, dump the puck exclusively to the corners away from the goalie's trapezoid and angle your forecheck to cut off the escape.
Those five principles take the overwhelming chaos of a high-speed game and turn it into a predictable, manageable system of probabilities. Once you see the game through this lens, you stop seeing random collisions and start seeing a highly structured chess match played at 20 miles an hour.
It really is a cohesive mental model of risk management, spatial awareness, and physics. Which brings me to a final thought I want to leave you with, connecting this back to the real world. Think back to the beginning of this deep dive.
The Tulski data.
We talked about Eric Tulski's tracking data. That data completely revolutionized professional hockey by proving that our intense human fear of a highly visible failure, the turnover at the blue line, was tricking us.
It was making us play scared.
It was making us choose a mathematically disastrous safe option, which was dumping it in while we slowly bled away our chances of winning. It makes you wonder. Look at your own life, your career, your investments, or your business. Where are you choosing the metaphorical dump and chase just because attempting a controlled entry feels too risky?
That's a great question.
What blue lines in your life are you giving up too easily because you are afraid of a visible turnover when the math actually screams that you should carry the puck?
That is a fascinating way to look at it. The data tells us to trust our ability to carry the load and to accept small failures rather than just throwing the opportunity away to feel safe in the moment.
Exactly. Sometimes the safest feeling play is the one that actually guarantees you lose. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you have gained a new lens, not just for watching hockey, but for analyzing risk, geometry, and strategy in any chaotic environment. Keep questioning the conventional wisdom. Remember to check your rule book. We'll see you on the next one.